We're now very pleased to invite Brother John King to address us this evening to the title Hezekiah and the Ambassadors of Babylon.
Thank you, Brother Anthony, and good evening, class members. Now, it's good tonight to deal with a chapter only with 8 verses. When I looked at last class, I might put this down a bit further. When I look at last class, we had 38 verses, quite a change. But before we get into Isaiah 39, I just want to just touch on one aspect at the conclusion of the destruction of Sennacherib. In Isaiah 38, you'll remember when Hezekiah was given that extension of life, we find there in verse 20, in his prayer of thankfulness, Yahweh was ready to save me. Therefore we will sing my songs to the stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of Yahweh. And I made reference in previous classes that this, amongst other things, would be a reference to the songs of degrees which Hezekiah organised. He didn't write them all, but he certainly collated them and put them in a certain order for temple worship. And there were 15 in all, which could be identified, say, with the 15 years extension of Hezekiah's life. They are found in Psalms 120 to 134. We are not going to deal with those songs in any great extent, but if we have a look at Psalm 126, I think that Psalm 126 is a very interesting psalm because, in my view, it highlights the wonderful deliverance which the nation received by the hand of Yahweh when those 185,000 Sennacherib's army were destroyed. Psalm 126. And you notice there the heading is a song of degrees. When Yahweh turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. It was so incredible that they looked upon it as though it was almost a dream, that they thought it wasn't real. It's like the dreams we have at night. And when we wake up in the morning, we're usually pretty glad they're not real. And that was what they thought. They thought, this can't be true, that so many would be delivered by so few. That phrase, by the way, turned again the captivity of Zion, it doesn't actually mean that they were captives. It's a phrase in the Hebrew which means a restoration of fortunes previously had. For example, if you turn over to Job 42, right at the end of Job's life, that phrase is used, illustrating how that Job was restored by the hand of Yahweh to much that he had before. In Job 42, verse 10, you know how that Job, after his time of great trial, was blessed immensely. And so we read in Job 42:10, and Yahweh turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also, Yahweh gave Job twice as much as he had before. So that's exactly the way the phrase is used in Psalm 126. When they had a restoration of fortunes, of possessions, of blessings, then that was like turning again the captivity. And they thought it was a dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the heathen, Yahweh hath done great things for them. See, that's the heathen speaking. The nations around Israel looked upon this deliverance as a remarkable event. And we're going to see that tonight. That is true. They looked upon the deliverance of Israel as something quite out of the ordinary. They could not believe how Israel could be saved from the great army of Sennacherib. Then you've got the nation speaking in verse 3. They're joining in. with the surrounding nations, that Yahweh hath done great things for us, whereof we are glad. Turn again our captivity, O Yahweh, as the streams in the south. Now, with regard to that next verse, verse 5, if you go to Isaiah 37, which we just keep your finger there in Psalm 126, but in Isaiah 37, which we looked at last class, one of the signs given to Hezekiah was that despite the devastation in the land, despite the fact that Sennacherib's army would have stripped the land of every conceivable vestige of life almost, and the crops would have been ruined, and the cattle and sheep and whatever would have been taken, we read in verse 30 of Isaiah 37, "This shall be the sign unto thee. Ye shall eat this year such as groweth of itself, and the second year that which springeth of the same. And in the third year sow ye, and reap, and plant vineyards, and eat the fruit thereof." Now you can appreciate those who had corn would have been a little reluctant, wouldn't they, to go out and to sow that corn in the field, because once you've sown that corn, what have you got left? They didn't have a massive storehouse of corn in Jerusalem that would see them through for 5, 6, 7 years. They had very limited resources. They had been under siege by Sennacherib for some time. They were down to the last of their reserves. And once they went out and sowed that corn, what did they have left? You see, it was an act of faith to go out in the third year and sow that corn. Now, the psalmist picks that up, you see, in Psalm 126, verse 5. Because they go out and sow in tears, and they're sowing in tears because they see the last of their reserves being used up. What's going to be left after that? It was an act of faith. But though they sowed in tears, they would eventually reap in joy, just as Isaiah predicted. "And he that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, the last of their reserves, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him." So he goes out with just a small amount of seed and comes back with his sheaves in his hand, as it were, although many months later, no doubt. Now, you may like, in your spare time, to actually go through those Songs of Degrees, Psalm 120 to 134, 15 of them, and I think you will find quite a number of references to the experiences of Israel during the time of the siege of Sennacherib. And we go back now to our last chapter in this interesting story in Hezekiah's life, in Isaiah 39. Now, if Isaiah 37 described the great heights of spirituality to which Hezekiah reached, then quite obviously it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, in Isaiah 39, we have the exact opposite. We have Hezekiah's low point. So you've got a man who reached great heights and also a man who reached lows. And it's good, you know, for us to sort of consider that, because in life, that is what life is like. You see, if we were to read the scriptures and only read of the high points in the servants of God's life, then I think we would feel a little uncomfortable, because we would think, well, here they are always on a high, and yet we know from our own experiences that we have highs and lows. And if the lows were never recorded, then we would feel as though we are a little divorced from the true saints of God. But here's a man who reached great heights and yet came down very low. I mean, another man that comes to our knowledge is David, isn't he? David was a man after God's own heart. And yet, he also reached a great low. And it reminds us of those comments in Corinthians, "Wherefore he that thinketh he standeth, take heed, lest he fall." And that's certainly what happened to Hezekiah. But before we look at this low point in Hezekiah's life, let's pick up the order of events. So we'll go back now to 2 Chronicles 32. And I think when we look at this, we can trace the beginnings of Hezekiah's decline in spirituality. It's quite an incredible decline when we consider the man of great faith that we have considered so far in all the classes dealing with the life of Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 32. Here we are now back at the deliverance by Yahweh from Sennacherib and his army. Verse 22. Thus Yahweh saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all other, and guided them on every side. Now remember in Psalm 126, we read of those words, the nations around Judah would say, Yahweh hath done great things for them. Well, here we have it, you see, in verse 23. The surrounding nations looked upon this deliverance with awe. They were amazed. And so we read in verse 23, and many brought gifts unto Yahweh to Jerusalem, and more importantly, as far as tonight's subject is concerned, and presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah, so that he was magnified in the sight of all nations from thenceforth. Now, to me, that is the beginnings of what eventually led to Isaiah 39. There's nothing wrong, you see, in anyone receiving gifts. Hezekiah couldn't just stand at the gates of Jerusalem and shut the gates and say, I refuse to receive any ambassadors from surrounding nations. Really, in a way, as Hezekiah would reason, it would be a good thing for the ambassadors to come, to hear of our deliverance, to hear of the way in which our God defeated the gods of the surrounding nations. So there was a good thing, you see, for the ambassadors to come. And as each one came, so they brought their gifts. And once again, there was nothing wrong in Hezekiah accepting those gifts. But you see, the trouble is that as time went on, he began to think very highly of his position. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Look at verses 27 to 29, just to get a picture of the way in which Hezekiah was greatly blessed. And Hezekiah had exceeding much riches and honour, and he made himself treasuries for silver and for gold and for precious stones and for spices and for shields and for all manner of pleasant jewels, storehouses also for the increase of corn and wine and oil, and stalls for all manner of beasts, and coats for flocks. Moreover, he provided him cities and possessions of flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him substance very much. Now that is a very important statement there at the end of verse 28. For God had given him substance very much. Now had Hezekiah always remembered that reality, then I doubt whether he ever would have fallen from grace, if he had have remembered that statement. But unfortunately, he didn't. Now, you know, it wasn't just gifts from surrounding nations that came to him. You turn over to Isaiah 33, I think it is. Yes, in Isaiah 33, this chapter has been looked at in our classes earlier with Brother Brian. There's a contrast made there between the spoiler, which the Assyrians were. A woe was pronounced against the Assyrian because of how they in turn would be spoiled. See verse 1. Woe to thee that spoilest. And that's what the Assyrians had done. They'd conquered every nation and taken away spoil. And no one could stop them until Yahweh stepped in. Woe to thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, then you will be spoiled yourself. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. And you may recall in the class how that the suggestion was made, for example, in verse 4, how that the inhabitants of Jerusalem, after the destruction of Sennacherib's army, would rush out through the gates, and there the army would be, 185,000, all dead corpses. But around them, you see, would be the spoil of the army. And so, the inhabitants of Judah, in verse 4, rush out, and they take the spoil of Assyria. Your spoil, that is the Assyrian spoil, shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar, as the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. Now you know what caterpillars do. When caterpillars devour leaves of plants, they don't, generally speaking, just eat one or two leaves. They eat the whole lot. And when locusts fly in a massive plague over crops and vines, etc., they devour everything in their path. Nothing is left. And that's the sense of verse 4, that when the inhabitants of Jerusalem went out of the city, they grabbed everything they could see. They took all the spoil of the Assyrians. Nothing was left. And instead of the Assyrians being exalted, we have in verse 5, Yahweh being exalted, for he dwelleth on high. Now, so with that in mind, we go back to 2 Chronicles 32, because you see, I think it wasn't just gifts being brought by the ambassadors that made Hezekiah rich. They also spoiled the camp of the Assyrians. And in verse 23, he was magnified in the sight of the nations. Now, tragically, I believe this was the beginning of his downfall. You know, whenever we sin and whenever we depart from the ways of God, it's not always just a sudden sin. You see, sometimes sin is at the end of a gradual development in our life. Something develops whereby we give way on this and give way on that and this, and then till finally we commit something that is wrong in God's sight. Something that is, you know, in our eyes, very wrong. But quite often that is not something that's done, as I said, suddenly. It's something that gradually develops, where we become weaker and weaker in our conscience. And I think that's what happened to Hezekiah. You see, when the ambassadors from Babylon came, and he showed the ambassadors all his treasures in a moment, as we see it, of pride, I don't think it was just a flash in the pan moment of pride. I think it was something that had been building up for some time. And when the ambassadors from Babylon came, Hezekiah psychologically was at a very weak moment in his life. He had already given way for some time to the lusts of the flesh in allowing his pride to develop, to the extent that he was at his weakest moment when the ambassadors from Babylon turned up. We go back to Deuteronomy 17. Look at the specific instruction given to the kings of Israel. This is before they even had a king. In Deuteronomy 17, verse 17, talking about what a king should be wary of. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Well, Hezekiah didn't have that problem. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Now, that was a problem for Hezekiah, you see, because the messengers from the nations came to him and they gave him these gifts. I think the important thing there is that word himself. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. As I said, Hezekiah couldn't very well stop the messengers bringing these gifts, but it was the way he looked upon those gifts. What was his attitude towards those gifts? If he looked upon them as his treasures, and look at all my wealth, look at all my majesty and power, then that was the problem. When we turn over to 1 Kings 10, we are given an example of what happened to Solomon. Exactly the same thing, to a degree, that happened to King Hezekiah. In 1 Kings 10, and 1 Kings, could be 10, but anyway, we'll look at 11. We find that, 1 Kings 10, we'll look at that, verse 26. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the king at Jerusalem. And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars made he to be as the sycamore trees that are in the vale for abundance. Now, that I see as the beginning of Solomon's fall. When he fell in 1 Kings 11, it wasn't as though that was the first time he had a problem. He had a problem back there in 10 verse 26. You see, his desire, his glorying in worldly things, which he got, led inevitably to the problem of 1 Kings 11 verses 1 to 8. Had he not put so much emphasis on worldly possessions as he did, then he would not have fallen. And I think that's what happened to Hezekiah. He never intended to end up the way he did. I don't believe he ever set out deliberately to be filled with pride. But that's what happened, because he had all these gifts laid upon him. Let's go back then to Isaiah chapter 39. He was a man then that was very proud of what he had. He was magnified in the sight of all the nations. He had treasures, gold, silver in abundance. There was nothing that Hezekiah did not have that the surrounding nations had. A remarkable turnaround, wasn't it, from what the nation had experienced during the siege by Sennacherib. And as I mentioned, I think that at this point he was psychologically at his weakest point. Verse 1 of Isaiah 39. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah. Now, why did Merodach-Baladan send these ambassadors? Well, for a start, he was no different in a way to the other nations. They all sent their ambassadors, as we read in 2 Chronicles 32. But you know, I think there was a particular reason why Merodach-Baladan sent his ambassadors. You see, for a number of years, Babylon, as being a little sort of city-state, was part of the Assyrian Empire. But the Babylonians were on more than one occasion attempting to escape from the dominion of Syria and set up their own independent little kingdom. And from time to time they were successful. And at this time period in the history of Assyria, this king here, Merodach-Baladan, was having some reasonable success in establishing the kingdom of Babylon as an independent kingdom. Now, don't get in your minds as though this was a huge, big kingdom with vast territories under its control. It wasn't. It was just a small little city-state kingdom. Just a small area, but nevertheless, it was important because it had a degree of independence. Now, just think about this. The nations surrounding Judah hear of Hezekiah's remarkable deliverance. They hear of this strange event whereby the sundial or the shadow went backwards. They hear of the incredible destruction of 185,000 men of Sennacherib's army. Way over in the east, you've got this small kingdom of Babylon trying to establish itself independent of Assyria. And Merodach there, sitting on his throne, so to speak, thinks, I think we could benefit from a treaty with this man Hezekiah. I think it's time we got closer to Judah. If Judah can defeat Sennacherib's army of 185,000 men, just think what the two of us could do together. And more than that, thought Merodach, whatever Hezekiah's got, he's got something special, because his God can make the sundial, as it were, go backwards. Now, bear in mind, the Babylonians were pretty interested in astronomy, weren't they? Very interested. The Magi, as they were called, were interested in that sort of thing. You remember when Jesus was born? The wise men turned up because they said, we have seen his star. Now, what were wise men looking for over in Babylon? You see, they were interested in astronomy. And they had picked up some guidelines from the prophet Daniel as to when the Messiah should be born. And they worked all this out. And suddenly when they saw this brilliant star in the sky, they thought, oh, that must mean something. And so they set off on their journey. Well, here we are way back in the time of Hezekiah, and the magicians of Babylon heard about this remarkable event in the city of Jerusalem. And so Merodach thinks, well, we can benefit from an allegiance with this little kingdom. So he sends off his ambassadors. In verse 1 again, at that time Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah. Now let's just go back for a moment to 2 Chronicles 32. We'll do a little bit of this tonight, going backwards and forwards, because it helps us to pick up just what was going on. 2 Chronicles 32, and we read in verse 31, here's the historical account of what happened. Howbeit, in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him, that is Hezekiah, to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him, etc. Now that word wonder, in verse 31, is the same word translated as sign in verse 24. And the sign was, you remember Hezekiah asked for a sign, and the sign was the shadow went backwards on the sundial. So, you see, the nations heard about that. They couldn't understand how it happened, and quite frankly, neither can we. I mean, no one understands how on earth God can localise the setting of the sun or the shadows caused by the sun. We can't understand that, but it happened. It happened so much that Babylon heard about it, and Merodach sent his ambassadors over to make a few inquiries. He probably thought, well, you know, if they can affect the sun, what other tricks have they got in their bag that we could use against the Assyrians? So they're off over there to inquire about this sign. Not only do they want to inquire about the sign, but we also find in Isaiah 39 that Merodach sends a present. And the present would have been of sufficient wealth and value to impress, as he saw it, Hezekiah. Now, you see, this wasn't the first of the gifts that Hezekiah was given. We've already seen in 2 Chronicles 32 that a number of messengers came with gifts. This probably was the crowning event. This was the event that really impressed Hezekiah. There's no question of that. Probably the previous gifts came from more local nations. But here is an ambassador from Babylon. Babylon already was vying for power in the Middle East. And here comes the ambassadors with a gift in their hands. A very interesting passage in Exodus 23. Whilst it's not referring to the same context as this gift from the ambassadors, yet the principle is the same. In Exodus 23, Israel as a nation is warned against accepting gifts when they are asked to determine matters of judgment. If someone came to them with a matter to be judged upon, then they were told, never accept a gift. In other words, don't accept bribes. You can't accept bribes because you can't accept anything when you're determining a case, because that gift may cause you to give wrong judgment. And so in Exodus 23 we read in verse 1, thou shalt not raise a false report, put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Verse 7, keep thee far from a false matter, and the innocent and righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked. And thou shalt take no gift, for the gift blindeth the wise. Notice in your margin, blindeth the seeing, and perverteth the words of the righteous. Now, whilst the context, as I mentioned, is not the same in Isaiah 39, yet the principle is the same, that this gift from the ambassadors from Merodach, in my view, blinded Hezekiah's eyes. He didn't see through what they were up to. He thought it was just them paying their respects for what had happened in his city. He didn't see that what they were really getting at was, how can we two get together and form an allegiance against the Assyrians? Notice verse 2 of Isaiah 39. And Hezekiah was glad of them. Now, why was he glad? Why would he be glad because of the visit by the Babylonians? Was it because their present was so much grander than anyone else's? I mean, it's a bit like when you get married, isn't it? you walk into the reception where the... walk into the... what do they call it? The hallway where the reception's being held, and there on the table is all these gifts, and you look at the presents, and there are some no bigger than an engagement ring box, Pete, going up to a huge eiderdown, or whatever you call it. Huge presents. And sometimes you think, you know, do you judge how much you value someone by the gift you give them? Well, I don't think you do. But nevertheless, there are varying gifts. Well, here, a gift is given to Hezekiah. Why was he glad of this gift? Was it that he saw them roll up with, you know, 2 dozen camels? Gifts laid on, wacko, this must be a fantastic gift. I don't think he was glad because of that. I think he was glad because he was overwhelmed in pride that someone from such a far country as Babylon should turn up and give him a gift. It went to his head. You see, he thought nothing of getting gifts from the Moabites or the Edomites or whoever surrounding him, or the Syrians up north or whatever. Yes, he accepted their gifts, but for someone to turn up from Babylon, that was just too much for him. 2 Chronicles 32 makes it very clear as to what was going through his mind. Already, you see, his mind was thinking in the wrong direction. His heart already was being affected what was coming his way. And 2 Chronicles 32:25 tells us clearly what his heart was like. But Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him. Now, isn't that a revealing statement? What was the benefit that had been done to him? Why, the deliverance of the city from the Assyrians. But he rendered not again according to the benefit. For his heart was lifted up. And if we are in any doubt as to what that means, we have it there in verse 26. Notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart. He was a proud man. Now, in verse 31 of 2 Chronicles 32, we are left in no doubt as to who was behind all this. We find that in the business of the ambassadors who came to him to inquire about the sign, we find that in the midst of this, God left him to try him that he might know all that was in his heart. So there it is. And you know what that shows us, and that is this, that, you know, even ourselves, we don't always know what is in our heart. We may think we know. We may think we've got ourselves sorted out okay. But even Hezekiah didn't know, you see. And he was tested that he might know all that was in his heart. And what Yahweh found in this test was pride. There's no question of that. Yahweh found in this king pride in all that he had. Proverbs 11 tells us that this is a matter of concern in all our lives. Proverbs 11, verse 2. When pride cometh, then cometh shame. And you know, isn't that true with Hezekiah? Right up to this moment of time in his life, everything had been going well. When pride entered his life because of the possessions that he had, then we find cometh shame, as we shall see in a moment. But going back to Isaiah 39, and we find that he was glad of the visit from the ambassadors, and that was because his heart was lifted up in pride. I think that it does us well to think about that, because, you know, if God tested Hezekiah like that, he left him to try him to see that was all that was in his heart. Do you think, brothers and sisters and young people, that God doesn't do the same with ourselves? If God did that with Old Testament characters, would it be strange that he wouldn't do it today? Are we any lesser beings in God's sight? Are we worth any less in God's sight? I mean, none of us in a way are worth anything, but it is true to say that God does desire people to come to him and worship him in spirit and in truth. God is pleased with our worship. But if God tests people in Old Testament times, why shouldn't he test us today? Hezekiah's downfall was pride. He was influenced by flattery. But is that the only way that God tests people? How do we know when God is testing us? I don't think we can answer that, do we? Can any of you say at any given moment of time, as God is specifically testing us? We may be able to perceive it, but generally speaking, we go about our daily life, whether at home, school, work, the ecclesia, whatever we're doing, And we just look upon that as everyday things of life, not knowing that in all those little things, from time to time, there may be a specific test coming to us from God. And God is interested to see how we will react under those circumstances. Hezekiah's test was to see where he really put his trust. Was it in God or his riches? If you go back to Deuteronomy 8, we're just going to have a look now to two or three examples of how God tests people. Deuteronomy chapter 8. On this occasion, it had nothing to do with possessions. In actual fact, it was the reverse. In Israel's wandering in the wilderness, they were tested not because of what they had, but because of what they had not. Deuteronomy 8 verse 2, "Thou shalt remember all the way which Yahweh thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness to humble thee, to prove thee." Here's the exact phrase now with Hezekiah. "To know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no." So there was one man who was being tested as to whether he really believed in his God compared to whether he put his trust in his riches. Here's now a nation being tested as to whether they really believe God can get them to the promised land despite the privations of life. Genesis 22. He's another great man of God. He also was tested. What was his test? His test was, did he really believe the promises? God said to him, "In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." "Do you believe that, Abraham?" And Abraham said, "Yes, I do believe it." "Well," said the father, "I'm going to test you to see whether you really do believe it. I want you to take your son and take him up to a mountain, the land of Moriah, and there offer him for a burnt offering." And what was Abraham's response? Well, he came through, but you see, there was a test. Did he believe what God had said? And so we have it in Genesis 22 verse 1. "And it came to pass after these things that God did test," as it is in the Revised Version, the Revised Standard Version, the NIV, and probably many others. It is quite clearly better rendered as test. That God did test Abraham. And we could write after those words, exactly the same words that are found in Deuteronomy 8, to know what was in his heart. Did he believe the promises? In Judges chapter 3, here we are back dealing with the nation again. Judges 3. Israel was in the promised land. They had settled down. They had abundance of crops and cattle, flocks, riches. Did they really believe that God had given them those things? Did they really put their trust in God that he would continue to give them those things? Well, God left them in a way to test them. Judges 3 verses 1 to 4. "Now these are the nations which Yahweh left to prove Israel by them." And we could add those words, "to know what was in their heart, even as many of Israel as have not known all the wars of Canaan." Why were they there? Verse 4. "And they were to prove Israel by them, to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of Yahweh which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses." Well, there we have four examples. We have the nation, we have Abraham, we have the nation again. Can anyone remember the New Testament quotation which speaks about trial in a general sense? Not specifically, but just generally trials, as to are they for our benefit? Yes, that's good. In James chapter 1. Now, the reason why we're turning this up is to get us to see, brothers and sisters and young people, that trials, testings are not peculiar to Old Testament times. They are just as much today as they were back in those days, and they're there for a benefit, for our benefit. James 1, and could you read verses 2 and 3 perhaps, or 2 to 4, Daniel, please? And then we have, "If any of you lack wisdom to bear up under trial, Let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Now, the word temptations there in verse 2 in the Revised Version is trials. Count it all joy when you fall into divers trials, knowing this, the trying of your faith worketh patience or endurance, perseverance. Now, I think it's important for us to see that. You see, when we look at the life of Hezekiah, we may look upon him as being someone that's remote from us, but he's not really remote, is he? Because here he was put under trial and he failed. He failed because he didn't hearken unto his God. What happens when we're tried? I dare say that all of us have faltered in our life. Many occasions we have faltered. Why have we faltered? We've probably faltered because we haven't really had our mind centred upon the things that are right, upon God's word. And I think, therefore, it impresses upon us the need to daily seek that wisdom in verse 5. What do we seek of God? We seek wisdom, not worldly wisdom, but we seek wisdom, understanding, to be able to perceive difficulties and trials that come upon us so that we may overcome them. And the only way we're going to be able to develop in that way of wisdom is through the word of God. And I think that's important for all of us to appreciate that. I appreciate it in my life just as much as yourself. And there's not one here that has not faltered under trial. But thankfully, through the grace of God, we've sort of overcome and we've picked up. And we've picked up, brothers and sisters, by the word of God. And I don't think we can impress upon any of us so much as how important the word of God is in our life. Probably all of us do not spend as much time reading the word of God, reading the works of the truth, reading the magazines on the truth that we should. How many of us, when we look at our life, spend much more time reading whatever may come in front of us, which may be of interest? Maybe of interest, I don't deny that. But do we do it to the exclusion of the word of God? Is the word of God occupying such a very, very minute part of our life? And if it is, then I think we should take heed from the life of Hezekiah. Because the less time we spend around the word, the more I think we're going to be susceptible to falling in time of trial. Just in Proverbs 30, finally, we have how that the prosperity of Hezekiah, in my view, clearly was the reason for his downfall. And the proverb, the writer of the Proverbs, expresses the view that he doesn't want poverty or riches. He wants really a middle course, because either of those extremes he sees can be problems for him. Proverbs 30, verse 8. Remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but just give me food convenient for me, lest I be full and have riches and deny you by my actions and thoughts and say, who is Yahweh? I don't need him. I've got everything. Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. Well, back to Isaiah 39. I want you to notice particularly the way that the record tells us what was going through Hezekiah's mind. Why was he glad? He was glad, as I said, because of his pride. And it comes through in verse 2. Hezekiah was glad of them because of their visit. Now, I want you to notice the number of times the word his appears. Not a lot, but nevertheless it's significant in the number of times it does appear in this verse. He showed them the house of his precious things, the silver and the gold and the spices, and the precious ointment, all those things we read of in 2 Chronicles 32 that had been given to him, and all the house of his armour, and all that was found in his treasures. There was nothing in his house, nor in all his dominion, that Hezekiah showed them not. Now, there's a New Testament passage which in a sense, is the counterpart to this, because in Luke 12, and by no means is the man in Luke 12 like Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a great man, but Luke 12 does nevertheless indicate a similar frame of mind. And this was the problem in Hezekiah's life, no question. Luke 12, verse 15. Jesus is talking to his hearers, and he says, take heed and beware of covetousness, For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things which he possesseth. And then he gave a parable. And whereas in Isaiah 39 we had that word his coming through all the time, in other words, this is all the things I've got, well, in verses 17 to 19 we have the word I and my. He thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. And he said, this will I do, I will do this, and I will do that. And I will say to my soul, verse 19, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years, take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Now that attitude of mind in Luke 12 was really flowing through Hezekiah's mind. When the ambassadors came, he loved to see them, he was elevated in pride, and he took them on an inspection of what he had in the city. He welcomed them into his house. He didn't have to do all this. Why did he do it? Why did he take these ambassadors from Babylon all around the city, showing them his possessions? There could be only one reason. He was flattered by their interest. He was flattered, and he was won over by their subtleties. One of the commentators of the prophecy of Isaiah, not a Christadelphian, wrote these words. I haven't got them on an overhead, but I'll just read them out for you. It's quite good, really. It says, the faith of Hezekiah, proof against the heaviest blows, which it was in the time of Sennacherib's invasion, the faith of Hezekiah, proof against the heaviest blows, melts at the touch of flattery, and the world claims another victim by its friendship. Now, isn't that very true? Isn't that true in your own life, that you can be so strong in something? You could be very valiant for the truth in many things, and we are through the grace of God. And yet something happens, someone comes along, just happens to hit on the right chord, and we're overcome. The faith of Hezekiah, proof against the heaviest blows, melts at the touch of flattery, and the world claims another victim by its friendship. Now, what a fool Hezekiah had become. He was delivered from one Gentile power, that is the Assyrians, in a miraculous deliverance, and no sooner had that happened, he's now selling his soul to another Gentile. Now, I must just correct the statement I made there. When I said no sooner had this happened, I believe that the ambassadors from Babylon would not have come straight away. Who knows when they came? I think it would have been many months later. I mean, it takes a fair time to journey from Babylon anyway. And they would never have made the journey until they heard conclusively that Sennacherib's army had been destroyed. So I think you are looking a few months down the track. But, relatively speaking, it was soon after the defeat of Sennacherib's army. And don't we do the same? You know, we can look at Hezekiah, we can look at those in the Bible, we can look at brethren and sisters who fall, and sometimes we can't understand it, but you know, we do the same in our life. All of us have been delivered from the power of darkness, just like Hezekiah was delivered from the power of the Assyrians. We've all been delivered, and yet in our life, we go along and we sell ourselves again to the power of darkness. We once again give ourselves to the dominion of sin. And that happens. And sometimes worse in others. But it happens. We sell ourselves once again to the dominion of sin, that very power from which we have been delivered. Back in Isaiah 39, Isaiah hears about the visit. He comes to Hezekiah in verse 3. And he says to him, what said these men? And where did they come from? Now Isaiah would have known, I feel. He would have known that. But you see, he is drawing Hezekiah out, just like Adam and Eve were drawn out in the Garden of Eden. The angels knew everything that Adam and Eve had done, but they asked the questions, and they condemned themselves by their answers. So the question is asked, what were these men doing here? What did they say? Where did they come from? Now look at Hezekiah's reply, and this to me reveals why I think he was flattered by their visit. Now, I may be reading more into this than what's there, but it does seem to strike me like this. And Hezekiah said, they are come from a far country unto me.
even from Babylon. He was an honest man. He said, frankly, I was overcome. They've come from a faraway country, even from Babylon, unto me. And that really stumped him. It flattered him. His pride was elevated so much that he couldn't wait to take them round the city and show them all his possessions. And verse 4 continues. Isaiah says, well, what have they seen? What did you show them? Did you just take them into the entrance hall? Oh, no, says Hezekiah, I did more than that. Hezekiah answered, everything. All that is in mine house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. Just quickly, for a moment, go back to 2 Chronicles 32. When Hezekiah uttered those words, and when the ambassadors from Babylon came, did he ever stop to think of these words in 2 Chronicles 32, verse 29? Not that he would have heard these words uttered literally, but he would have known the principle of them. The latter part of verse 29, for God had given him substance very much. And now Hezekiah is saying to Isaiah, there's nothing in mine house that they haven't seen, and there's nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. And you can imagine Isaiah sort of standing there with his arms folded, I better not do that, and saying, tell me more, Hezekiah, tell me more. And he just would have stood there and just listened to Hezekiah, you know, just let all these words come out. And he was condemning himself by his own words. He never dreamt that by doing that, of the long tail, far-reaching, tragic consequences of what he had done. And that's what happens in our life with sin. Sometimes we do something and we never appreciate, perhaps, what the consequences may be. He just thought, oh, well, I just showed them all around my house. I showed them everything that I had. Well, then we read of the terrible words that were uttered in his ears. Verse 5. Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, hear the word of Yahweh of hosts. Now, we know the names and titles of God mean something. I mean, he could have said, hear the word of Yahweh, hear the word of Elohim. He said, hear the word of Yahweh of armies. Now, that meant something, because the next verses are an illustration of why the militant title of God was being used, because God was going to use his armies to bring judgments upon Judah because of their sins. And whilst Hezekiah was the cause of this in the beginning, yet really it was the sins of the nation that were the principal reasons why they were taken off into captivity. Hear the word of Yahweh of armies. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith Yahweh. I'd like you to notice a contrast between two verses. In verse 4, he says, there is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them. And verse 6 says, nothing shall be left. So, in other words, Isaiah is saying to the king, everything that you have showed to the Babylonians, there won't be one thing left in the city. The whole lot is going to go. Let's have a look at Micah for a moment, because Micah was a contemporary prophet of Isaiah. And it's quite interesting to note how that Micah also predicted the captivity into Babylon. In Micah chapter 4 and verse 10, because of the sins of the nation, Micah predicts that they shall be carted off into captivity. Be in pain and labour to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and thou shalt dwell in the field. See, it's a progression. They go out of the city, into the field, and then they're carted off even to Babylon. But, fortunately, there is a good end to that. There shalt thou be delivered. Now this prophecy, when it was uttered by Micah, was given about 100 years before Babylon even became a great power. And the same thing on Isaiah 39. When Isaiah uttered those words, as I mentioned before, Babylon wasn't a great major world power. It was just a small city-state that had dominion over a small territory. And yet, Isaiah's predicting that so great and powerful would Babylon become that they would cart off into captivity everything that was in the city of Jerusalem. Now, we could go through this, but we haven't got time, and you no doubt would know a lot about it. But there were three invasions by Babylonians, weren't there, effectively? Can anyone remember when the first one was? You better, because Mark dealt with this. So, number one, BC 606, and that is, well, it's recorded in the historical record of Kings, but Daniel chapter 1 verse 1 verifies that that is what happened, and, well, not just verse 1, but the rest of the verses in the chapter, and it also mentions that Daniel and his friends were amongst the captives taken captive then. So that was in BC 606 when the first major invasion by Nebuchadnezzar took place. What about the second one? Any ideas? Obviously BC, that's a clue. Right, so that's 596. Now, if you turn up to 2 Kings 24, I think this is a relevant chapter because that is the captivity that's been spoken of there in 2 Kings 24, the 596 one. And in the light of the prophecy by Isaiah in chapter 39, just see the way in which the record describes that captivity. Now, perhaps if we could have Peter Pullman, if you could read verses 11, 12, 13, and Danny Nichols 14, 15, 16. Now, when you read these verses, just bear them in mind. Bear in mind the light of what Isaiah said in chapter 39, that everything would be taken captive. Righto, verses 11 to 16. Thank you. Now, notice, say, for example, verse 13, that not only were the treasures of the king's house taken, and this is exactly what Isaiah said, didn't he, in Isaiah 39? Isaiah also said in chapter 39 that they would take that which Hezekiah's fathers had laid up in store. Well, we have an example of that in verse 13 of 2 Kings 24, that they took away that which Solomon, king of Israel, had made. So you see, it was not only what Hezekiah had accumulated, but what his fathers had also placed in the city. Everything was taken, exactly as Isaiah predicted in chapter 39. Right, well, when was the last invasion? And amongst other things, what happened in 586? Temple was destroyed. I'll just abbreviate to save me writing. Anything else? Yep, the city was burnt. And generally, people were taken away. Now, if you turn up 2 Kings 25, and Sim, could you read, thanks, 2 Kings 25, verses 9 to 11. Now, this is the third of the invasions by Nebuchadnezzar. Thanks. Now, just like you to notice, for example, the specific mention in verse 9 of the king's house. And what Isaiah said in 39, everything you've got here will go. King's house was destroyed, and everything in the king's house that was of any value was taken by the Babylonians. Well, now we bring the study to a conclusion in the next few minutes. Just go back to Isaiah 39. Not only were riches to go, but we read in verse 7, and of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget. Now that is an interesting prophecy, isn't it? Because remember Hezekiah, when he was sick, how many children did he have? None. Didn't have any. And that was one of his laments. He said, I have no one to carry on my name. Here he's given an assurance that he'll have sons. He prayed that he might have a posterity. And Yahweh says, you'll get a posterity, Hezekiah, but of your sons, your posterity, they're going to be taken away. They'll be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Just turn over quickly to Daniel chapter 1, which I referred to earlier. It's a reference to the first of the invasions in BC 606. We find that many were taken captive, although it doesn't specifically mention that in the first few verses. But in verse 3, we find that the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom there was no blemish, etc. So he was the master of the eunuchs. What happened to the king's seed? Were they made eunuchs? Isaiah predicted they would be. They would be made eunuchs and taken captive into the land of Babylon. Now what a terrible humiliation that would have been to King Hezekiah. And you know, to his credit, he humbled himself because of that. In 2 Chronicles 32, we are told specifically that upon hearing that terrible judgment, he humbled himself. We read in 2 Chronicles 32, after being told that he didn't rend again to Yahweh according to the benefit, verse 25, because of his pride. Then we read in verse 26, notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of Yahweh came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. So his repentance, his turnaround, was responsible for the judgment being deferred. It didn't happen in his day. It happened, of course, quite a few years later. In fact, about 120 years later. 120 years rolled by until the first of those invasions in BC 606. Now, when you consider the humbleness of Hezekiah, going back to Isaiah 39 then, this gives us an insight into the concluding words of that chapter. You see, sometimes we read that verse in verse 8, and we might think that Hezekiah is being very selfish, as if to think, well, I'm okay, I've saved myself, and forget about the rest. But I don't think that's his attitude. I don't think we could ever think that Hezekiah would think like that. It is rather him expressing confidence in the mercy of God. After he was told in 2 Chronicles 32 that the judgments wouldn't come in his day, his response to that in verse 8 of Isaiah 39 was this: good is the word of Yahweh. In other words, he resigned himself to Yahweh's will. It's not good, I'm okay. Good in the sense that we have benefited from the mercy of our God, which thou hast spoken. He said, moreover, for there shall be peace and truth in my days. If we turn to 1 Samuel 3, I think if we look at this section of Scripture, it just helps us to understand the way in which those words were used by Hezekiah. Remember when Eli was told of the judgments of God by Samuel? Samuel had to reveal to Eli that God's judgments were coming upon his house because of the wickedness of his sons, and Eli had done nothing about it. And when Samuel told him everything, we read in verse 18 of 1 Samuel 3, And Samuel told him every whit and hid nothing from him. And what was Eli's response? He says, "It is Yahweh, let him do what seemeth him good." And there, I think, is the same attitude of mind to Hezekiah. It was a resignation to the will of his God. He accepted that the judgments would come, but he was glad that they wouldn't happen in his days. Now, can anyone remember the caption that I put over the sections dealing with the invasion by Sennacherib? I suggested we could put a caption over the invasion time period as trusting God in troubled times. So Isaiah chapter 36 through to 38, you could have a caption over those chapters, trusting God in troubled times. But you see, in Isaiah 39, it's not so much troubled times, is it? It's a time of prosperity. It's a time of trial. It's a time of testing. If we turn to Proverbs 3, I think we can conclude our studies this year with this caption. And it's not only suitable for our study on Hezekiah, it's suitable for all our work in the classes this year. And it's suitable for our life totally, whether we are study leaders, housewives, young person, doorman, one that mows the lawn, which I do occasionally. Whatever our role might be in ecclesial life, doesn't matter what our role is, what is important in the eyes of God is what is our attitude to the things of God. Forget about what our particular role may be. God is interested in what our heart is. And if Isaiah 36 to 38 is trusting God in troubled times, what caption can we put over our life totally? Proverbs 3 verse 5. Trust in Yahweh with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. And I think verse 6 could be a fitting caption for our life, for Hezekiah's life, for anyone's life in the truth. If we remember that, then brethren and sisters, even though trials will come upon us, hopefully through the grace of God, we shall come through.